appreciate everyone's patience as we got started. A number of members obviously wanted to participate in the rally going on outside and in honor of Martin Luther King Day and all the other issues going on today, so we appreciate your patience. We're going to start out with our agenda, some possible measure introduction. Council Taylor.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have two bills for possible introduction. One is LC 363, exempts from disclosure under public records laws, public bodies plans in connection with threat against individual public safety. This is a bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that come to you through the Interim Judiciary Committee as a result of the analysis done by the Department of Justice in conjunction with the Governor's Office of the laws of Oregon as a result of September 11, 2002. And this would make it a little bit more difficult for people to get, say, the plant security plans of a public building or a public agency. It's a product of a work group and has, I'd say, generally broad support.
Any questions for Mr. Taylor? Hearing none, the chair would move the introduction of LC 363 as a committee bill.
So moved.
All right, next.
They approved of that.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the other one is LC 1770, makes technical advisory committees and task forces for the Office of Oregon Health Policy and Research subject to public meetings laws. That means there'd have to be notice given of these meetings.
Right. And that's LC 1770. Are there any questions of council on that bill? Then the chair would move the adoption of LC 1770 as a committee bill. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the bill will be introduced as a committee bill. We'll again have to apologize. The great location of our hearing room at times leads to a bit of distraction during days when many people are visiting the Capitol, so we'll have a little competition with what's going on behind us. It does remind me, however, that there was a hearing, I think. Do you remember this?
1999.
In the 99 session in this hearing room where there was some event occurring on the steps of the Capitol where there was music being played. And the music almost it coincided with people's testimony. And so as, I just remember that, I hope I'm not mistaken when I say this, I think it was Mr. Jim Marquis who came up at one point to testify, and at that point there was sort of a sinister change to the tone of the music, and the entire hearing room burst out laughing. I mean, it was just a great, interesting, which caused us to wonder at some point if we ought not to have theme music for everyone who comes and testifies in front of us, sort of a soundtrack for the committee. We're going to start out, and the chair would open a public hearing on House Bill 2177. Mr. Taylor, you want to do just a brief introduction, and then we'll ask the witnesses to come forward. Oh, okay. Mr. Prince, I'm going to need to get a full list with who the players are, I guess, to know who's...
As we get further in, we'll just... hopefully be here. One of us will be here
right.
For one day.
Great.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2177 was requested by the governor on behalf of the Department of Corrections. It is a bill that would, it's pertaining to stalking orders. It would bar an inmate in Department of Corrections from getting a stalking order that would restrain an employee of Department of Corrections or an agent of Department of Corrections from acting within the scope of the person's official duties. I think that Mitch Morrow and Jeff Van Valkenburg can tell you the specifics about why DOC is asking for this.
Why don't we ask Mitch Morrow, Jeff Van Valkenburg, and Mary Botkin if the three of you, or the three people who signed up to testify, would come forward. You all right all sitting together? Okay.
Okay, but don't tell anybody.
And Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I also, in your packet, put together a little background on what a stalking order is and what needs to be shown in a petition for to get a temporary stalking order and a definition of some of the terms. I know they're probably not familiar to some of you.
Okay, thank you. Who wants to start?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mitch Morrow. Assistant Director for the Institutions Division for the Department of Corrections. And I'm here to provide some information and to ask for support of House Bill 2177. As Craig indicated, this would amend Oregon's civil stalking protective statutes to make clear that inmates could not use these statutes against officers, employees, or agents of the Department of Corrections. In the past 2 years, this has occurred in a couple of occasions, and in fact, one occasion, a temporary order was issued against an assistant superintendent of one of our medium custody facilities. Due to the provisions within the statute, a temporary order can be issued against an employee without much burden of proof. They can simply just present their allegations to the court, and the temporary order is, in fact, ordered. The availability of temporary stalking protective orders provide inmates an unnecessary opportunity to use the state courts to take actions against specific staff or intervene on the daily operations of the institution. We believe it was not the intent of the statute or the intent of the legislature to provide this avenue to inmates within our institutions. We have both administrative and judicial remedies available to the inmates to render their concerns or to bring forward any complaints that they might have, and I think that gives the inmates within our facilities the opportunity to address or gives them avenues to address, again, their concerns they might have. So the Department of Corrections respectfully urges the passage of House Bill 2177. Thank you. Answer any questions there might be.
Why don't we go ahead and have the other two members of the panel testify, and then we'll take questions. So
go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Bodkin. I'm here today representing multiple hundreds of Department of Corrections employees who work inside Oregon's prisons every day. And we have similar concerns to the department that inmates are using the courts in an unfair manner to prevent officers and staff from properly supervising and seizing property which could be used improperly, be considered a weapon, or could be contraband, any number of things. If you have the opportunity to read the order, it's pretty broad. And as a person who supported and co-requested the original stalking bills, I can assure you that it was never our intention to protect those individuals who are in custody, in some cases, for violence against the very people we were trying to protect with our stalking laws. So we would also urge the committee to go ahead and pass this bill quickly, and let's get it onto the governor, get it through the Senate, and get it on the governor's desk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm the general counsel for the Department of Corrections at the Attorney General's office. I'm here today at the request of the Department of Corrections simply to be available to answer questions about some of the litigation problems the department has seen. There's been about half a dozen of these cases brought by inmates in the past 2 years. We did have one temporary court stock and protective order issue. We have one case that is currently pending that the Department of Justice is defending in Malheur County. In that case, you might find it interesting that the allegations relate to whether or not an inmate will receive his 20 or 30 boxes of legal materials on the timetable that he wants to receive them. As I read the statute, at a bare minimum, one of the requirements is that it puts someone in objectively, in fear of their personal safety. And unfortunately, this is a remedy which is available. It is very extraordinary. Some judges have felt that they've been compelled by the allegations to issue them, and that's why the department has brought this bill forward.
Thank you, Jeff. I guess I'm curious about the one instance where the judge actually granted the order. Were there particular facts and circumstances in that case that made it unique from the average case where such a order would typically be viewed, that, you know, a guard at an institution ought, yeah, most judges I think would normally not go down that road. So I'm interested in the nature of the one case where it did happen.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, this was a case out of the Two Rivers Correctional Institution in Umatilla, and the allegation of mistreatment by the inmate was against the security manager or the assistant superintendent for security in that facility. The allegations were, and I'm just going to paraphrase because I can't tell you details off the top of my head, were that the assistant superintendent had cornered the inmate approached him out in the yard and basically threatened him with not getting out of that institution, not being transferred to the Valley unless he behaved himself. Now, the inmate certainly alleged some other types of conduct which concerned the judge, but we did, my office did seek to dismiss that, and it later was dismissed. After being transferred, frankly, the venue was transferred to another county. I think it's highly unusual. In most cases, I think we would agree that an inmate is not objectively in a position where he can claim that his physical safety is at risk in an institution. And there are certainly other remedies available.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. Mr. Valkenburg, I guess it's the... I'm amused by the bill, but I am curious, too, following up on Representative Williams' question, and obviously it's in those other allegations that the court must have found something in order to issue a stalking order. I mean, obviously to say you're not going to go to the Valley and to behave yourself, I don't think we have a judge in the state who would issue a stalking order based on that. What was the other conduct?
I do have the complaint, Representative Shetterly and Chair members. Here are the claims. Over a period of 6 months time frame, the security superintendent, assistant superintendent, intentionally, knowingly, and recklessly engaged in repeated and unwanted contact with the inmate, thereby alarming and coercing him. This contact includes, but is not limited to, repeatedly verbally threatening the inmate with harm and the intent to coerce, intimidate, constrain the inmate from exercising his constitutional rights. So the first allegation deals with retaliation for exercise of constitutional rights. We see those claims all the time with all sorts of other remedies. Again, it's not very specific what the claim is there. Repeatedly directing and causing the inmate physical and mental abuse by the imposition of physical and mental punishment against upon the petitioner, the inmate. Plaintiff in retaliation, again, in retaliation for exercise of his constitutional rights. There, the allegation is that the security manager imposed punishment on him, which, as the security official in charge of that institution, that is his statutory function, to impose punishment when the rules are violated. Third allegation, repeatedly committing acts of official misconduct by using the power invested in them, it's against two folks, to order their subordinating staff to inconvenience, harass, punish the inmate, which left him in constant fear. On several occasions, the corrections officials obstructed and blocked state police investigation. They made false and contradictive statements to investigators to hide their actions, causing severe apprehension, fear, and emotional injury to the inmate. Again, my understanding of these statutes is emotional injury, that kind of fear is not actionable. It has to be some sort of physical harm. Repeatedly engaging in criminal conduct, unspecified, just listing a bunch of the criminal stalking statutes. The inmate goes on to allege it is objectively reasonable for a person in his situation to have been alarmed or coerced by the contact complained of. The repeated and unwanted contact complained of caused the inmate continual reasonable apprehension concerning his personal safety, and he suffered actual and foreseeable injury to his person and property as a result. Those are the factual allegations as they are.
Representative Ackerman.
I'm not clear as to whether this order was issued just on the allegations of the petition or upon a full fact-finding process. Can you inform us of that, please?
Yes. Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, members. What I understand is that in this particular case, a temporary court stalking protective order did issue without a hearing based solely on the allegations contained in the complaint. That's what the statute permits. In fact, it's what the statute requires. If the court finds that the allegations meet the probable cause standard to meet those criteria. The case, my office moved to have venue in the case changed to the county where the institution was located, back to Umatilla County. We filed additional motions to dismiss, and the case was dismissed. A permanent order did not issue. So the court essentially found ultimately that the facts were not borne out.
Representative Prozanski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Some of the questions have already been asked pretty well takes care of what I was concerned with, but I had two things to follow up on. One is, which county did it actually issue from, if it wasn't Umatilla, where the actual incident was alleged to occur? And second, was this done by affidavit in the sense of, I thought that those orders, when you apply for them, either you are in front of the court or in person, or you have some type of affidavit that has to be filed to give the basis besides just the allegations.
Chair Williams, Representative Prozanski, members, to the best of my knowledge, this based solely on the allegations in the complaint. It issued in Marion County. It may be that the judge who issued the order is here today. We understood that he was coming to speak to it. He might obviously have a better idea of the specifics of it, but I don't believe that there was an affidavit filed in the case. I could be wrong.
I have a note. The judge that issued the order was Judge Lipscomb. My understanding is that he did wish to be here today to testify, and he could not come today. And I think were Judge Lipscomb here, he would say that the wording of the statute he felt mandated that he issue the order, and that he didn't feel, given the way the allegations were stated in the complaint, the statute gave him any leeway not to do this. Having myself actually worked for Mr. Van Volkenburg at one point in my career as a law clerk over the Department of Justice, and having spent some time on the corrections related litigation that came out of this, once one of these things is successful, yeah, it typically moves through the institution with the jailhouse lawyers at quite a rapid rate. And so to the extent that somebody's found something that works once, it gets used and reused quite a bit and creates a substantial amount of additional work, both for the institution in having to respond to it, for the Department of Justice in having to respond as the institution's law firm for it, and for the courts that, frankly, are in the position of having to manage this. Representative Shetter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think I agree that this is not exactly the situation we had in mind when we adopted our stalking statute. By the same token, just in trying to take a global view of this and having seen some movies in my time, you know, in the event of real misconduct by a corrections officer directed against an inmate, I guess in removing this this avenue, what other recourse, I guess, do inmates have? I just, if we could put that on the record so we have some discussion of that, so that we are not, by removing this as an option, we're not removing other state and federal recourse that you would have in the event of that one in a million case of real abuse of authority within an institution.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetter, members of the committee, prior to this remedy being available, at least arguably so, inmates for many years have had recourse to the state and federal courts in a variety of ways. In this state, habeas corpus is a remedy for violation of constitutional rights, including allegations of physical mistreatment. In this state, typically, counsel is appointed to represent the inmate and to prosecute the case on behalf of the inmate. In addition, there certainly are criminal official misconduct statutes which do apply to physical mistreatment claims. In my tenure as general counsel for the Department of Corrections, I have seen district attorneys bring cases, indict inmates, staff, on allegations of physical mistreatment, and they have gone forward. Now, we know that juries sometimes are reluctant to convict, but those cases do go forward. And in addition, the federal courts, the civil rights actions brought under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, which has available to it as a part of it the opportunity for an attorney who prosecutes a case for the inmate to cover attorney's fees as the incentive for bringing those types of actions. Okay. Those remain available to inmates for this kind of action. So there are a number of state and federal remedies that are effective, that are real, and which will remain if this committee and the body acts on this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I want to thank you. I think I knew most of that. I just wanted to get it on record for other members of the committee who may not be aware of that we do have substantial remedies for real cases of abuse that predated this and that will still be there if we take away this particular one. And I think the you know, what makes this so prone to overuse and abuse on the inmate side is just because it is so easy, and it only requires probable cause standard and the basis of the allegations. And so you just fashion the petition the right way, and you've got at least a temporary order, and I can see enough of those issuing, and you've got chaos in the institutions. But I think it is worth noting on the record that we do have state and federal remedies available in real cases of abuse to seek redress.
Representative Brzezinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this discussion brings up two points. I was wondering if we can get comment from the witnesses on one of them, and the other one's really for the, I guess, both for the witnesses and also for the committee. Whether or not the Department of Justice thinks that maybe we should look at the stalking temporary issuance on more of a threshold than just the allegations. Shouldn't there be some type of affidavit required to be filed in those type of cases to at least support the allegations that are being alleged? Now, I understand that these are very effective in many different avenues and different venues, and so I know that's something that we'd have to really think about, but I'm wondering if you can give us your comments on that, as well as whether or not, based on what we know has happened in this one particular case, do you think an emergency clause would be appropriate for this type of legislation, since it would not go into effect until next January, if it does, in fact, pass?
Chair Williams, Representative Brzezinski, members of the committee. I'm not here for the Department of Justice today, and Department of Justice does not have a position on this bill, so I don't know what Mr. Myers and my office would feel about that. What I can tell you in my conversations with my clients with Department of Corrections is that they're concerned about the availability of this remedy. They're concerned that, irrespective of a showing of proof, that it's inappropriate to have this extraordinary remedy apply in the environment of a custodial environment in prison because of the potential for abuse that Representative Shetterly has ably described. As far as what was your second question?
Emergency clause.
Emergency clause.
Oh, yeah.
I'll let Mitch speak for the Department of Corrections. What I can tell you is that the Department of Justice is defending one case presently.
Yeah.
I don't know how long it'll take for that to wind its way through the courts, but an emergency clause could immediately be effective to moot out that case.
I had any other questions down at the center of the table? Yes, Representative Jensen.
Have we talked about the...
You'll need to pull your mic.
Sure.
There you go, Representative.
Have we talked about the one case that the Department of Justice is defending at the present time?
Yes. Well, is that the same case, Mr. Van Volk?
No, it is not. It's a case that the case that we talked about, in which the temporary order issued, was dismissed in Umatilla County. The case that is pending in Malheur County, and it is active. No temporary order has issued, however. The court refused initially to order a temporary order.
Okay. So it's still pending.
Still pending.
One of the questions I had was in the language on line 14, as you add the additional exception language for an inmate of the Department of the Institution or a Department of Corrections Institution can't do this if it's brought against an officer employee, and then it says, and B, acting within the scope of the person's official duties. Is it going to be just a... Is it your opinion that saying that or alleging in the complaint that the person was not acting within the scope of the person's official duties is going to jump over this in such a way that the court will feel just additionally hemmed in if someone pleads it that way?
Chair Williams, members of the committee, this is something that my clients and I have looked at. We do have some concern. I think it is correct to say that in most cases, most judges will, hopefully with some prodding from my office and some legal argument, will tend to believe that it isn't objectively reasonable for the inmates to bring these sorts of actions. That does not mean that this doesn't close the door, is the short answer, Chair Williams, that to the extent that an inmate could allege in his complaint without any sort of affidavit or other sort of showing up in the front that the correctional officer or staff acted with such malintent, the sole purpose being to cause the inmate physical harm or severe fear of physical harm, that could get through the door and an order could issue properly under those allegations. So it is a potential problem.
Yeah, and I think that's that would be, on the one hand, trying to find a way to close that door in part from the frivolous allegation is what we're trying to accomplish here. On the other hand, the balance, of course, is the language that you've recommended and are supporting, or the department's neutral, but DOC wants, does leave the door open for a situation if that were to arise to file. And my only concern is, it's more of a question than a concern, is there a way for us to write that language that doesn't leave the door open so broadly that one simply needs to allege that it was beyond the person's scope of their official duties, and therefore jumps right over that. And I'm recognizing again that a temporary one, given that allegation, might be required to be issued, and we're right back into the same mix.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the question really fundamentally for this committee is, do we want to make stalking orders available to inmates of corrections facilities? And if we do, then, you know, under what conditions? Or if we're going to say no, we're going to leave them to their other state and federal remedies, then, you know, then the answer would be, I guess, to delete sub B there and simply make it an absolute prohibition and say, of all the remedies in the basket, this is one you don't get to use. You still got habeas, you still got 1983, you still got, official misconduct, all those other remedies that you've outlined, but this is one that wasn't intended to cover inmates in correction institutions, and we're just not going to make it available. The last thing I would say is, I guess if we're going that direction, the other question I would have would be to what extent this implicates inmates of county jails and facilities, and whether an amendment would be in order there if we're going to go that direction.
Well, and I also was going to ask the question about whether or not a person who is currently on parole is considered an inmate for purposes of the statute, because I think that's also a different situation. I don't believe that's the case, but I don't know enough about the definition of inmate of a Department of Corrections institution to know whether or not that might also subsume somebody. Claudia's shaking her head, so I think we're at least clear on that. So it's not going to be impacting anybody who is not actually in physical custody of the department. Is that right?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Chair Williams, Representative Charlie, if I could add something. Since you're looking at these potential issues, there's one more, and the additional issue is that there are also criminal stalking protective statutes. And it seems if you're interested, as my clients are, in closing the doors, and we think it's proper, that's another piece to look at.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I agree with Representative Shetterly's position that taking out the acting within the scope of the person's official duties doesn't make sense. And going back to Representative Przonski's piece, once these issues get loose in our legal libraries throughout our institutions department-wide, there will be a tumbling effect of the other inmates, and you will see many more of these coming our way because of that access to the success of the one case. So that's just for additional information for the committee.
Mr. Chair, may I make a comment as well?
Sure, Mary.
I think it's real important that the committee understand that the professional men and women who work for the Department of Corrections do not tolerate inappropriate or unprofessional behavior among their colleagues towards inmates. The way you keep an institution orderly and safe is by fair and equal treatment, and by making sure that the rules are enforced equally between the inmates and the people who are held accountable. I mean, part of the job of those men and women who work there is to teach the inmates accountability for their behavior. In my unprofessional opinion, you know, this could be used if suddenly we house an inmate in an institution they don't want to be housed in to get to the institution of their choice. And that is not an appropriate use of a stalking order. We have any number of internal procedures that the inmates are allowed to use or encouraged to use. They have grievance procedures. They have appeal rights. You know, anytime they have a concern about the way they are being treated, Oregon is known as one of the states who really does give its inmates an opportunity to have their kind of day in court when they feel like they're being treated unfairly. And I think it's very important that the committee understand that there's a difference between you know, legitimate concerns, which people will find. I mean, if they're there, Mr. Morrow's not going to let it slide. You know, we just don't. Nobody tolerates that behavior inside the institution, because the officers know that the way you stay safe is to run a good institution, a good, clean institution with the inmates. And, you know, this is just kind of over the edge. And I agree with Mr. Van Valkenburgh that once they find out you can do this, then they do all have time to figure out a way to do it to their own best advantage. And whether it's just a day in court or just to harass an officer or a staff person that they don't like, you know, we really do need to be able to separate this. And I just don't think that I don't think they deserve the same protections as an abused spouse or a child or whatever. And I was going to comment with Representative Przanski's statement about increasing the standards. My only concern would be that the standards have been fairly low for the protection of folks who are really at risk out in the community rather than in an institution. And I'd be concerned about increasing the standards too high for fear that we would see some drop-off of legitimate stalking orders being issued for folks in the community who need them.
Mr. Chair?
Just putting on the record.
Representative Shetterly.
Well, yeah, I guess, you know, I think that is a different issue. And if there are abuses outside in the community where this is being used, then let somebody bring those forward. I don't want to necessarily kill that goose while we're trying to get at this one. I mean, that's a different question. If there are abuses out in the community use of this, and I think my tendency would be to favor a lower threshold of access in that environment. So I would hate to make that harder to get at while we're looking at this. I'd just as soon decide whether or not we're going to make stalking available inside an institution, yes or no, and then make this bill work on those lines.
Further questions for this panel? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As we've discussed the possibility of broadening this, interestingly, my witness list is growing. And now I want to give Ingrid Swenson, and if you want to bring anybody else up, Ingrid, you're welcome to. You know, the advantage of having your bill on as the first substantive bill of the committee is that it's you know, a great opportunity to be on the curve. The downside is that we're so starved to actually start doing anything that we're going to just read every single word and treat it as if it's the most important bill of the session, because we haven't got our hands on anything substantive for months. So there's the downside to being the first bill.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to comment. Indeed, we were not planning to testify on this bill, but as I hear the comments from committee members, I do have some concerns about that. And I think the principal one is that when we talk about stalking, there are going to be problems with various officials against whom stalking orders could be brought. I mean, police officers are a target that I don't think have, you know, yet encountered this, but clearly could. And it's because of the breadth of the stalking law. It's extremely broad. It's an unwanted repeated contact, and not a great deal more than that has to be shown. You just have to show that it alarmed you, it made you feel threatened, and clearly if the police come to your house on multiple occasions, you might decide, well, that's threatening me.
Ingrid, under this definition, half the lobby constitutes that
yeah.
problem.
I didn't want to mention that, but I was worried about that.
An unwanted threatened contact.
It's literally true. And I think those kinds of issues need to be addressed in the stalking law. You may or may not get to those this session. I know there's a stalking reform bill. However, as the bill was drafted, I think the provision that requires that an officer be acting within the scope of official capacity is a good limitation. If you take that away and say inmates simply cannot use this, I don't think that's a good way of dealing with the misuse of stalking, because presumably there could be an officer who decides to either stalk a member or an inmate or a member of the inmate's family. And if you take that remedy away, it sort of permits that to happen. So I think there are ways of exempting corrections officers from inappropriate efforts by inmates to take this kind of action. But I don't think just making them exempt from it would be the appropriate way to go. So,
okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Crummell.
So if I sort of understand your comments correctly, what you're suggesting is that, let's just kind of go to a far-fetched possibility here. We have an officer who likes or dislikes or whatever the case may be of a particular inmate and decides to go to that inmate's wife's or ex-wife's or spouse's place of employment to kind of see what the spouse is up to, then that would not be enacting in their professional capacity. So therefore, they could then be, I know indicted is not the right word, but I'll use it anyway, for stalking of the inmate or the inmate's family and making the inmate or the inmate's family feel threatened in some way. Is that, am I understanding your comments correctly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, that's exactly correct. That would be our concern, that officers not acting in their official capacity could undertake to do something inappropriate, and the remedy would therefore not be available to the spouse or to the offender.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Crummell.
So I guess there's actually two questions here. One is this something that happens a lot? And is sort of the first one that comes to mind. And then the second one is that then if the officer is basically at work and doing the job that they're supposed to do, which is generally to observe the inmates and their activities and to keep them on a corrective path, then that would be within their scope of professional duties and therefore would not be subject to, and do you think the court is going to see that as well?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I think that I would agree with Chair Williams that there would be a better way of expressing it probably than just the scope of official duties. And I don't know what that is, but I think there would be a way to address that properly without exempting corrections officers. Not quite sure what it would be. But clearly, prison inmates ought not to be able to get stalking orders against correctional officers who are performing their duties appropriately. And I think under the current stalking law they can. So I'm not saying that a remedy isn't needed here, but I think getting rid of the right to a stalking order is not the appropriate remedy.
Representative Jensen and then Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The implication here is that the inmate's family, significant other or whatever it may be, would not have recourse under the stalking statute if this bill were enacted?
Mr. Chair, Representative Jensen, if the expansion that was discussed, making it applicable to the criminal provisions as well as the civil provisions and removing this limitation on page 2, then, yes, I think that the potentially the family member of the inmate who was either threatened through the inmate or in some way in relation to the inmate might not have an appropriate remedy.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If it's outside the scope of their official duties, they can get the stalking order, and if they're going bothering the wife, that would certainly be outside their official duties. And there's also a lot of regulations. If a prison guard's known to be associated at all with the family of an inmate, they'll lose their job. So I think that they would, that the inmate and the family would still have plenty of protection, even if we excluded the Department of Corrections officer from being subject to a stalking order from an inmate within. I think your concerns are still covered under a variety of other laws, including stalking orders.
Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, as long as this language is in here about official duties, but the proposal was to remove that.
That isn't what I heard. I didn't hear that.
No, the discussion was to remove that piece, and that's my concern, is that if that comes out, then...
Right. There was some discussion about whether or not we ought to remove the in the course of your official conduct language, because my concern is that we do this, and yet all someone has to do is potentially allege that whatever actions were done outside the course of their official conduct, and you immediately put the judge back in the same position of potentially having to issue the temporary order. So it is a balancing issue, and we are, again, I just keep adding names to the list as we have this discussion. It really is fun to have the first bill because we're just so anxious to talk about all the detail.
I want to thank Mr. Taylor for scheduling this slam dunk bill right at the top of the agenda.
We have before us now Brian DeLashmit, and who are we representing today?
Representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I read the bill, simple bill. I just wanted to put on the record that we support the bill. I've heard the discussion, but let me reinforce actually what Representative Barker indicated on the official within the official duties. If a corrections officer, police officer, parole and probation officer do some function that's outside of the scope of their practice, there are a variety of remedies that include potentially through the division expulsion, suspension, revocation of their certificate as a corrections officer, police officer, and so forth. So there's already those protections. And if you're talking about the hurdle that you want to, or the door that you want to have a closed a little bit more, obviously we need to explore that a little bit more. But the concern of the committee is that somehow if you deal with this particular area, you are closing the remedies that a inmate or the inmate's family has for something that is done outside of the scope of that officer's job. I don't believe you have to really worry about that.
Brian, let me ask you a question, because it seems like this isn't, and in fact, as I remember a little bit of recent history involving corrections issues and inmates, that this has been known to happen on occasion. If there's a situation where an inmate or a corrections officer takes a fondness for an inmate, what is the and the inmate perhaps isn't interested in and doesn't feel the same way, and given the nature of life and people, and I would imagine that if I wanted to, I could bring up somebody from the Department of Corrections who would have to tell me that this on occasion has happened, because I think that's just the nature of people and people who work together and see each other on a daily basis and form relationships and affections and the like. What happens to a corrections officer in a situation like that? Because I assume that at the same time, there's some effort on the part of the union that represents that corrections officer to make sure that he's not entirely mistreated in this process either. Should an inmate start to suggest that they think an officer is taking an unusual amount of interest in the inmate in a romantic sort of a way?
Mr. Chair, perhaps that question is best posed to the Department of Corrections as to the case types of cases and what the process has been. Obviously, it depends on how far it goes. Whether in fact they violated that individual's civil rights, they violated some other criminal or civil statute, whether it goes to the point of harassment, sexual harassment, rape, whatever. Obviously, the inmate has access to all of those codes.
Mary?
I actually testified on this bill, the sexual misconduct bill, last session, and worked with the director at the time, and it was amazing to me where we found the problem to be. The problem was not with our male officers and female inmates, as we all kind of anticipated that we would find. The problem was with our female officers and male inmates. And in many cases, those officers have resigned their positions. There comes a point, Mr. Chair, where they just have to make a choice. And interestingly enough, in about 95, if I remember right, I have to go back and look at my testimony from last session, but it was like an incredibly high number, like 95% of all reported cases of inmate and staff inappropriate behavior or activity was reported by other staff people, was not reported by inmates. It was not through inmate complaints. It was through the complaints of colleagues and other staff people. you know, it does compromise the security of the institution, or it could. And again, I just want to reiterate, our folks just don't put up with it.
Well, to bring us back full circle, Mitch and Jeff want to come back up. So right where we started from.
Mr. Chair, while they're coming back up, may I just sort of pose a question that I don't know if somebody out there or one of you as lawyers would want to answer, and that is, given the far-out example that I gave, if a family member was feeling threatened, even if that line 17 was deleted, they would still have the other portions of the statute, because they would actually be the ones that are harmed in that case, not the inmate. And so they would still have the other aspects of the statute to be able to fall back on. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, I think that's accurate. Okay. Jeff or Mitch?
Chair Williams, Jeff.
Okay.
Members of the committee. Interestingly, we've anticipated some of your questions today, and I actually have a draft of amendments to this bill that cover most all the points that we've discussed in the past 45 minutes. One way to deal with Ms. Swenson's concerns about family members is to prohibit actions brought by or on behalf of an inmate, under the stalking statutes, and leaving the family members to bring it on their own behalf, leaving that intact should there be that kind of conduct off the job, off site. But I do have language that my clients asked me to prepare in anticipation of their needs, and I've shown it to Mr. Prinz. But essentially, there's a statute that's on the books now, ORS 163.755, which I've used as the model. It's existing law that exempts certain types of labor activity, and it's readily adaptable for this purpose, if the committee would desire.
What I would like to recommend is that we're not planning on taking this bill into work session today anyway, so that we would go ahead and feel free to circulate your draft amendments. If you'd like to, I'll authorize counsel to have them prepared. At the same time, I want to give, obviously, Ms. Swenson and her folks the opportunity to look at those as well, and if they've got alternate language that they would like to propose, that's also another alternative. And as a separate amendment, I'm going to ask that we have Legislative Council prepare an emergency clause, which, regardless of how we shake out on this other issue, we would likely want to put on the bill before we refer it to the floor. So are there any other questions? Council Joseph, you had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of an answer in need of a question, but I was wondering if the concern is that the automatic issuance of a temporary stalking order comes out, is there a way to eliminate that automatic issuance with respect to corrections officers? In other words, if the complaint involves a correction officer, the automatic restraining order does not issue, and that would get away from inmates being encouraged to file these things, even if they put in their language to get around the provision on within or without of the scope of your official duties, as long as they're not going to get that automatic restraining order and they're going to have to wait for a full hearing, that would eliminate that incentive at least.
Williams, Mr. Joseph, members of the committee, I can't speak for the Department of Corrections. What I can tell you, and Mitch, you can speak to your policy concerns, what the application and availability of this remedy does is to expand remedies for inmates. And if that's what the legislature intends, it may do so. Certainly, we've got judges out there who believe that this legislature did do so. And we are continuing to defend against that proposition in the courts. The cleanest thing from my client's perspective, of course, is to do as Representative Shetterly suggested, which is to simply remove this particular remedy for inmates. There certainly are ways to do it through gradation. Certainly the most immediate problem was the availability of those temporary stock protective orders. Yes, that's the most immediate concern. But with certainly in my line of work, over the past decade or so, I have seen the movement to be to curtail, through appropriate legislation, frivolous inmate lawsuits. The availability of this remedy based on allegation is a real problem. So,
okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
I'm sorry, just one last thing. I think if we're getting amendments, at least one ought to we consider, and we can talk about it, whether youth authority ought to be included in this as well. I mean, if we're talking about institutional facilities, we ought to look at the right. whole waterfront.
Well, in your issue about county jails, I think was another appropriate, and I'm going to ask council to sort of look at those issues and confer with the usual suspects before we move forward. But we'll bring this bill back. It was a fun way to kick off the first substantive bill of the committee. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2177. And we're now going to move on to House Bill 2057. We'll open a public hearing on that bill. And we'll see if enough interest can be engendered to bring witnesses up three or four times. Of course, our only witness on this bill is George Reamer from the Oregon State Bar. So, George, you may have to sit down and come back a couple of times so we can get the same feel.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Reamer, and I'm Deputy Director and General Counsel of the Oregon State Bar. There are three aspects to this proposed bill. One has to do with the elections of members of the Oregon State Bar Board of Governors and House of Delegates. Lawyers elect other lawyers to serve on these two bodies, and from time to time we will have a nomination process where we just have one candidate, and we're proposing that in those circumstances essentially we not go through a ballot process, which requires sending a ballot out to everybody and getting the returns back and tabulating the results, and that they would just be considered elected if there are just if there's just one nominee for a position. The second component of the bill basically seeks to give a break to lawyers who have been members of the Oregon State Bar for 50 years or more. We already exempt them from payment of bar membership fees, but there is a separate assessment for what is called the Client Security Fund, and we're proposing that these 50-year members have an exemption from the payment of that fund as well. Currently, for 2003, it's only $5, but if we already exempt them from payment of full membership fees, sending them out a bill for $5 doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to us. The last item is a change in the statute that deals with the appeal of disciplinary sanctions. And currently, the rule is that matters that result in a suspension for more than 6 months or beyond that are automatically reviewed by the Oregon Supreme Court. This change would basically eliminate that automatic review and would entitle, as a matter of right, either the Oregon State Bar or the accused lawyer to ask for the Supreme Court to review the matter. Otherwise, for example, if there's a suspension for a year and the bar is satisfied that and the accused lawyer is satisfied that, we wouldn't have to have the Oregon Supreme Court take up its time to review it and approve that. So those are really the three components of this proposed bill.
Are there questions for Mr. Reamer about the bill? Yes, Representative Krummel.
Mr. Chair, I guess I'm only wondering about the last section dealing with the automatic Supreme Court review. Why would there not be automatic Supreme Court review when a suspension from law practice for a period longer than 6 months? It seems to me that if a person's being suspended for 6 months or longer, that's a pretty hard hit on their pocketbook. And I'm just curious as to what kind of cases would be for longer than 6 months, and why you picked 6 months, and what about someone that's suspended for 3 months?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krimmel, this has evolved over the course of time. The statute used to say 60 days. Anything over 60 days, the Supreme Court would automatically have to review it. After that worked quite successfully, we came back to the legislature and said we'd like to make it 6 months. I guess this is kind of an evolution of the concept that with the bar being able to ask the Supreme Court for review and the accused lawyer being able to ask the Supreme Court for review, and then the court would have to take the case if either one or both wanted to have the case reviewed, we felt that that was an appropriate check. If the lawyer is satisfied, considering, you know, being represented by counsel and evaluating the court's prior precedent regarding a potential sanction, that a year for the misconduct is appropriate, then we wouldn't have to take up the Supreme Court's time to consider the matter. So there's still a right to have the court review it. It's just kind of eliminating it automatically having to be reviewed if the bar and the accused lawyer are satisfied with the disciplinary board decision that imposed that sanction.
Let me ask this question, if I could, George. If both sides choose not to have it reviewed, if we were to do this, would the Supreme Court still publish the notice of the decision of the bar with respect to the discipline in the disciplinary section of the I mean, there is a publication that occurs on these things, and would that still happen in this case, or would it not?
Mr. Chair, we publish a publication called the Disciplinary Board Reporter,
right,
on a yearly basis,
right,
and that has a fairly limited circulation, but is a public document,
right,
and lawyers who defend lawyers and people in the bar that are involved in these matters have access to that, and these decisions would still be final decisions of the disciplinary board, which would go in there, and also we do publish a summary, a summary of a decision in the Oregon State Bar Bulletin on a monthly basis, and those would continue. Yeah, this would be an official decision, a final decision of the disciplinary board.
What it would not require, though, is that because the Supreme Court, then, when it also reviews, doesn't it have some publication that it does as well?
Yes, they would put that in the advance sheets.
And they would not do that in a case where either side...
Yes, because there would be no Supreme Court decision. It would just be... more or less the disciplinary board decision becoming final.
Right, okay.
Without an appeal.
Okay. Representative Krimmel, the point obviously is that if either side was unhappy with the result, they could get the same level of review that they're getting now. But what this would say is that if both sides were satisfied with the result and the lawyer didn't necessarily feel like he needed the Supreme Court to look at something that he was already agreeing to by a one-year suspension of practice, then they wouldn't have to have the Supreme Court take the time to review it.
Gotcha. I did want to mention, Mr. Chair, one thing that we obviously have a corresponding rule of procedure that the Supreme Court has to approve, and we have broached the topic of, you know, coordinating the statutory change with the change that would be needed in the bar's rules of procedure. So we still need to talk. We've broached the subject with the Supreme Court, but we need to talk and coordinate that with the Supreme Court.
Okay. Representative Sherry.
It just seems to me that in a session where we're focused on budget, relieving the court of an obligation to review a case where the parties are in agreement would be one way we could eliminate some unnecessary court activity.
And I'm confident that Representative Ackerman is pleased with the 50-year practice requirement that you don't have to pay that $5.
That's right.
50 years is an incredible period of time to practice law.
Any other comments or questions for Mr. Reamer about this bill?
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Oh, I don't know.
It has representation.
I think we're going to just not take it to a work session today. So we're going to close the public hearing. It just seems wrong to have the first bill on the floor be a discussion about lawyers. So,
and Mr. Chair, wouldn't we also have to flip between the freshman members as to
You know, we don't have to flip, actually, Representative Perzanski. I just get to choose.
Chair, perhaps we could reschedule this for work session in May.
May. We will obviously return to that bill. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2050. And no one signed up for this bill.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you like me to explain the bill?
Would you please?
Sure. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2050 comes from you from the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. And if my memory serves me correctly, this is an issue that you had an interest in, Mr. Chair.
That's true.
It includes in the definition of child abuse, the purpose of child abuse reporting provisions endangering the welfare of a minor if a minor is present where methamphetamines or a precursor of the methamphetamines are present. This means that a doctor, lawyer, police, firefighter, teacher, or other professional listed in 419, I should say, I think, B0053, knows that a child is present where methamphetamines or a precursor methamphetamines are present, but the individual must notify the Department of Human Resources.
Colleagues, the thought about this bill has stemmed from several years of discussion in this committee and information that we've been privy to over time through testimony about the incredibly harmful effects of the manufacture of methamphetamine, the chemicals that are used, the toxins that are given off as a result of the manufacture, and from a lot of folks from the law enforcement and from the Services to Children and Families folks that have testified over time. The often presence of children in this environment. And so over time, we've discussed what we could do as a committee to address the issues of child welfare as it specifically related to the manufacture of methamphetamine. Last session, as I recall, and I see Mr. Cerise from what used to be called Services to Children and Families, and before that was the Children's Services Division, and now is the Department of Human Services, Children, Adults, and Families. Someday we'll just have, I don't know how we're ever going to learn that. I don't know that I'll ever remember that. But we did pass a bill out that added, at least as one of the factors a court could consider in making a determination about the termination of parental rights, was whether or not the child had been exposed to the manufacture of methamphetamine in that analysis. And this is essentially another step to add the reporting requirement of potential abuse or neglect, essentially, in this concept of abuse reporting. I know there are some issues that have been raised already with me about the fact that, you know, there are precursors to methamphetamine that are not necessarily the manufacturer of methamphetamine, that in their inert form, the precursor in and of itself might not necessarily be a problem. A precursor to methamphetamine, as we saw in a video during the last interim where we were taught how to manufacture methamphetamine from folks by the Department of Drug, or was it ATF or was it DEA that came in and showed us the video? But you could have a box of Sudafed or Actifed or some other ephedrine drug, which is a precursor to methamphetamine in its inert legal form, and that might be broader than we might want this to be. And we could, you know, is it a precursor if it's sitting on the shelf, or is it only a precursor if it's in the process or in some other issue? So there are issues associated with this. It was a bill that we wanted to bring forward and have a committee discussion about. I know Ingrid has raised some concerns about it. Ingrid, do you want to come up and discuss this at all? You're welcome to. I don't want to put you on the spot if you don't want to.
Yeah.
May I decline for today, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, you may.
Unless there are questions, I'd be happy to.
Do you have questions, Representative Shatterly?
No, I appreciate your comments on this. I mean, you know, one of the issues, and I was looking for the volume that has this, and it's not here. The standard for reporting, what level of knowledge is required?
Oh, I have it.
You have that? No, that's fine, but we can look at it later. But as being a member of a mandatory reporting group, along with teachers, doctors, and everything else, this does get into a pretty complicated statute in terms mm-hmm. of what constitutes endangering. And I see that this is not predicated on conviction or even the charging of that violation, but just on facts that would constitute a violation of it. And so it may implicate a fairly high, sophisticated level of knowledge of what's in that
right.
bill on the part of all the groups that are mandatory reporters, and that's a little problematic.
Yeah, counsel points out that the language here is endangering, and that the endangering word there acts as somewhat of a qualifier. But again, I agree with you. It's not a simple issue, but yet it's one that I think we feel, because of the testimony and the evidence over time that this committee has been presented with the impacts, we want to figure out a way to approach this. I certainly am not married to any particular language and would actually invite people who have an interest in this topic to come forward and help the committee work itself through this issue on how we best address this problem. But yet I don't think that it's something that... And oftentimes in those situations, there may be plenty of other mandatory reporters that are reporting for other reasons. But it was a gap that we felt like we might want to fill to make sure that in this instance, somebody wasn't able to go through this process knowing that a child was involved in and in the presence of this manufacturer of the methamphetamine and be sent back home or not treated as if they have to address this issue. Counsel's pointing out to me the portion of the statute that says any public or private official having reasonable cause to believe. So that's your standard, Representative Shirley, reasonable cause to believe. Yes, Representative Barker.
Mr. Chair, just in the summary, it doesn't mention manufacturer. It just talks about methamphetamines present, but is the statute more specific than that?
No, you're right on for what it currently says in the draft language and the bolded language.
So, I mean, if somebody just had some speed in the house.
Yeah. So I will say that I think is currently drafted 2050 is broader than we're probably going to go. The question is how do we refine it in such a way as to sort of hit the subject matter. Okay. And again, I'm willing to work with Ingrid and others to try to make that. And Mickey, to the extent that you guys have suggestions you want to raise as well. Any other discussions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Well, just very quickly, on there may be a statutory definition of a precursor of methamphetamine or other forms of drugs, and I'm just throwing that out. So when we have an inquiry on that, I didn't have time to look it up before we came here this morning, this afternoon.
You know, we do almost every single session, it seems, redefine what constitutes a precursor because they change the recipe based on the availability of chemicals that we have begun to regulate as a precursor. And so there's almost every session, or at least every session I've been involved, there's been a new precursor bill to catch a new set of chemicals because we've held them down on some kind of iodine, and now they've moved on to something else that they're going to use. And so we've had to modify that almost every time. And so that's another issue that we're going to have to obviously look at. Yes, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chairman, is the intent that if the precursors are there in the process of fabrication of the methamphetamine, that makes them dangerous, or just having any precursors there?
Well, and I think that's the problem. I think there are some precursors that in their inert form probably don't cause a significant risk. It might be something, frankly, that you have in your garage.
Yeah, right.
So that's a different situation than when they're all sitting next to a bathtub, either preparing for
in the
process of cooking the methamphetamine. And I think that's the issue that we're going to have to try to refine. Right. To make sure that we don't cast the net so broadly that we're impacting all sorts of people with this burden, but at the same time not just ignoring it because it seems difficult to try to define. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a kind of quick question. Based on the wording here, I see the terminology of youth being person under 18. Supposing that this is a juvenile offense that's the taking place where the manufacturer is under 18 themselves. Is there going to be some statutory provision then that in I don't know, you know, the law here, but in the juvenile codes someplace that includes this similar language?
No, I don't believe so, Representative, and I haven't thought that through all the way, but it would seem to me that this would be in the same sort of a situation, whereas as a mandatory reporter, if you were to become aware that a older but yet juvenile sibling was abusing a sibling in that family, as a mandatory reporter, the fact that the bad actor was a youth themselves wouldn't change in any way, shape, or form your obligation as a mandatory reporter to report the situation, even though the individual doing the abuse was an adult. Are there any questions? Okay, so, sure. Counsel.
Members of the committee, let me read to you the endangering the welfare of a minor. A person commits a crime of endangering the welfare of a minor if the person knowingly B permits a person under 18 years of age to enter or remain in a place where unlawful, let me emphasize this, unlawful activity involving controlled substances maintained or conducted. So that, let me once again emphasize unlawful. So the fact that you had antihistamines in your medicine closet is not an unlawful activity. If you had enough of them in there and you were intending to cook them, then that would be an unlawful activity. Now, I think Representative Jensen's raised an interesting point. In a sense, I guess it would be possible if a juvenile were under the age of 18 manufacturing a controlled substance that they would be endangering their own selves and could be theoretically prosecuted under this provision. But I don't think that would be, I guess it could happen, but I don't think a DA would prosecute.
Well, we're not going to obviously address this to any greater detail today. We put it on more than anything to sort of raise the issue, and we'll bring it back. Obviously, people who have comments or suggestions, I'd encourage you to work with Mr. Taylor as the bill moves forward. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2050. And we are now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2099. And I would ask Andrew Arbatine from the Department of Justice and Jim Gardner to come forward. Please proceed.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my name is Andy Aubertine. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Oregon Department of Justice, and my primary responsibility for the past 13 years at the department has been in antitrust enforcement and advising state agencies and the legislature on antitrust issues. I appear here today as representative of the Oregon Department of Justice in support of House Bill 2099. Along with me is Mr. Gardner, who will also be speaking today. It's not only the Oregon Department of Justice that supports this bill, but members of an interim committee that was formed by Attorney General Myers shortly after the 2001 legislative session. If I may give the committee members a very brief history of how that committee evolved from the primary issue it was looking at until to the bill today, it might be helpful to get some context. I appeared before this committee in 2001 in support of a bill that would expand standing to bring certain actions under the Oregon antitrust law. It was a bill that ended up as a compromise bill, and as part of the compromise, Attorney General Myers had agreed to form an interim committee to address some concerns that were raised by Mr. Gardner and others relating to the scope of indirect purchaser standing. Attorney General Myers instructed me to form a committee of members from the defense bar, the plaintiff's bar, from consumer groups, as well as the business industry, to try to come up with ways in which we could resolve some of the concerns that came out of the last session relating to that law. Members of that committee included Mr. Gardner, Professor Ed Brunette from Lewis and Clark Law School, Barnes Ellis, a very noted attorney in the Portland area, John McGrory, Gary Grenley, Betsy Earls, recently departing from Associated of Oregon Industries, and Truman Stone from the Oregon State Bar. The committee met many times over a 6 or 7 month period in 2002. We did not reach a resolution or unanimity on the principal issue of whether we could find a way to expand or change the scope of the law that was presented to the legislature in 2001. However, during the course of those meetings and the analysis that we undertook, it was clear, and I believe that the committee was unanimous in its belief, that the Attorney General, as parens patriae in protecting consumer rights, has a role to play in consumer class actions, and that there ought to be ways to look for ways to better enhance that role that the Attorney General can play. So the committee shifted away from looking at a way to expand the consumer's remedy in indirect purchaser actions, and we moved to the direction of looking at what the Attorney General's role could be in class actions. And this is a bill that speaks to class actions. And if I may just take a moment, this is a bill where lawyers in the private sector may bring actions on behalf of consumers as a class who have common interests and are similarly situated, and they may bring a class action under the Oregon Antitrust Act. One of the issues that was raised as part of the committee's discussion is whether consumers have the ability to track, monitor, and force their private class counsel to account for the actions that they undertake on behalf of consumers. And one of the ideas that came out of the committee was, is there a way for the Attorney General, as parens patriae, to be able to better track the development of these lawsuits and the resolution of these lawsuits, even when the Attorney General itself is not a party to the action? So as a result of that, there was this proposal to require lawyers in the private sector who bring actions, class actions under the Oregon antitrust law, on behalf of natural persons, not on behalf of businesses, but on behalf of natural persons, where the action is brought and then there's a settled resolution of the claims where these consumer claims are released, notification must be provided to the Department of Justice of the lawsuit when it's filed and the settlement. And the idea behind this is for the Attorney General to have the opportunity to review the nature and the scope of the settlement. Problems sometimes arise, and I do want to stress sometimes arise, when some of these settlements do not appear to be fair, adequate, or reasonable for consumers. The two areas that seem to be given the most attention where consumer settlements are at issue is when an attorney's fees is presented to the court, and there may be excessive attorney's fees request involved, in which instance, and in some instances, class members or attorneys for class members will object to the amount of the attorney's fees that the attorneys are seeking. Another area where the settlements may not be adequate for purposes of consumer benefit is the nature of the settlement itself, where instead of perhaps money, even though the consumers may have been injured, rather than have the money returned to them in restitution for their losses, they may have coupons that they can go back and buy more product from the same company that violated the law in the first instance, or seek services from the same company that violated the law in the first instance. It's not to say that coupon settlements per se are bad, but it is to say that coupon settlements on occasion can be abused to the point where the purpose of the lawsuit is diminished. So this, Chair Williams and members of the committee, is a way that this interim study committee saw a way to give notification to the Attorney General of the types of lawsuits that are being brought on behalf of consumers, settled on behalf of consumers, so that we may take a look and see how these settlements are playing out, and if the settlement is adequate and fair and reasonable, that's as far as the review goes. But if it is not, then the Attorney General has some options in which to try to address those concerns with class counsel. I might add that what this bill does not do, and I think it's very important to note this, that the bill does not change the class actions attorney's responsibilities to provide fair and adequate notice to class members of the settlement in question. It does not change any of the rights of the class members to be given notice and an opportunity to be heard on their own or to opt out of the settlement. And it does not change the court's role whatsoever in reviewing or approving the settlement that's been presented to it. Ultimately, it's still and always will be the court's decision to determine whether the settlement is adequate or not. This gives the Attorney General a little bit better opportunity to be aware of those cases, particularly the cases that we're not involved in, to see if the consumer's voice is being heard and the consumer's rights are being adequately carried out.
Why don't we go ahead and have Mr. Gardner make his comments, and then I'm sure there'll be some questions.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jim Gardner. I'm an attorney with the Gardner & Gardner Law Firm in Portland, and I'm appearing today for Microsoft. Andy correctly represented the nature of the interim committee and the the compromise which was reached last session with regard to the Illinois BRIC indirect purchaser issue, which was basically to vest Andy's office with the parens patriae authority to bring those claims on behalf of Oregon consumers. That had the salutary effect of A, avoiding the risk of duplicative recovery, but also giving Andy and Attorney General Myers the ability to participate in the national settlements that are often the denouement of many of these cases on an equal footing with all the other states, so that Oregon would get its fair share. The interim committee was a very balanced committee with representation from both the plaintiff side and the defense side of the bar, as well as Mr. Aubergine said, Ed Burnett, who is a leading professor of antitrust law at Lewis and Clark and a nationally recognized expert on this particular issue, the potential abuse of coupon settlements. So we think we have a very good, useful tool for the Department of Justice and a bill that, if passed, could well become a national model for the National Association of Attorney Generals.
Thank you, Jim. And I want to first let you both know that during the interim, I appreciated you keeping me informed of the progress of the work group. I apologize that given the 5 special sessions and the like, I wasn't able to be more active, because it would have actually been more fun than the 5 special sessions, despite the subject matter. I have a technical question, Andy, that you might be able to help us out with. Does the Attorney General already have the authority under existing statute to, if I know this is more a notice provision, so you're aware of what's proceeding, but if he already does know about it, does he have the authority under current existing law to come in and appear to intervene in the case and argue that the settlement may not be in the best interest of consumers? Is that something that currently exists, and does that happen on occasion at this point?
Chair Williams and members of the committee, the answer to your question is yes, the Attorney General already has the authority to intervene or to appear before a court as parens patriae to, particularly in settlements involving consumers, Oregonians, to raise objections, comments, or perhaps to even support the settlement that's being presented to the court for final approval. This bill truly is and only is a notice bill.
Right. Okay. And this is just to make sure that you guys get a chance to review all of them and not just the ones that you find out about by either your own work or having read it in the paper or whatever else is occurring.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, that is correct.
Okay. Representative Ackerman.
Yes, just a couple of questions. I view this as being purely a notice requirement and not being a jurisdictional requirement. Is that correct?
Chair Williams and Representative Ackerman, yes, that is correct.
What I'm concerned about would be what are the consequences of class action counsel in failing to comply with these provisions. The consequences aren't written in the Act. I wonder if you have an opinion on that.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, and members of the committee, that was actually an issue that was raised by the committee members during our deliberations, whether or not to include some type of sanction or remedy for failure to abide by the requirements. The committee members decided to not put that type of language into the bill for basically 2 reasons. First, we have very experienced class lawyers on the committee, and I have done a number of parens patriae class actions myself. It is true pretty much across the board that lawyers on both sides, once they've arrived at a settlement, are very, very particular in dotting the I's and crossing the T's to ensure that the settlement will proceed to finality. They will look for all of the, and they have an incentive to do so. So they are going to be looking for ways to make sure that they have done everything they possibly can to move the settlement toward resolution. If they do not provide notice, that puts that resolution at risk. Secondly, we believe that the court, the federal courts and the state courts have significant discretion in determining already whether or not to delay a final approval of the settlement or to provide some other relief if notice hasn't been provided. And then we still retain the ability to argue that perhaps we need more time to review this if notice hasn't been given in a timely fashion.
And one last follow-up.
Yes, follow-up.
If your office does not intervene, do you still feel you have authority to participate in the settlement process?
Representative Ackerman, Chair Williams, members of the committee, we feel that we do. There are a number of different ways to participate in the settlement process without formally intervening. We still may bring to the attention to the lawyers any questions or concerns that we may have about the settlement. We may file a friend of the court brief to raise issues about the settlement, whether it's fair or adequate or not, or what other ways it could possibly be made better. Truthfully, in a number of these cases, the Attorney General is a party to the action where we're bringing actions on behalf of consumers as well. So we think that with this added piece of legislation, this will help us cover the board on that.
Thank you.
Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Albertine, as fuller background for my understanding of the need for the legislation, could you just describe the scope of antitrust class action activity in Oregon so I can get a sense about how often this requirement would apply?
Representative McPherson, Chair Williams, and members of the committee, in terms of the numbers of cases, I would say that, and I'm basing it purely on the numbers of the cases that the Oregon Department of Justice has been involved in on behalf of consumers in the last 5 years, there are anywhere from an average of 2 to 3 cases per year where there are antitrust class actions brought on behalf of Oregonians. I think what's a little bit deceiving is that these actions do not necessarily have to be filed in an Oregon court. They can be filed in a federal court in another state, such as in the federal court in Illinois or New York. What's key is whether there are also state court actions or state court claims that are brought in addition to the federal court claims on behalf of consumers. And oftentimes what attorneys will try to do, and are very successful in doing that, is bring what's called a national class lawsuit, alleging claims on behalf of consumers nationwide. And they will rely upon the specific state statutes in each state to help form that class. And so when I put the number out there that 2 to 3 actions per year, it's in the context of federal court actions where state claims are brought in to add to the federal court actions that may be filed in courts other than Oregon. And the issue then becomes in those cases, and I think Representative McPherson sort of implicit in the question is the Attorney General a little bit more attentive to actions that are occurring closer to home? And I think the answer is absolutely. We are going to be aware of state court actions involving purely state claims in Oregon court. We're certainly going to be aware of federal court actions filed in Oregon federal court. It's going to be much more difficult to track the lawsuits that are filed in Georgia, New York, or in other parts of the country. And I think this speaks to that and the ability to take a substantive look at the settlement.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions? Colleagues, there is a draft report on amending the Oregon Antitrust Act to expand indirect purchaser monetary remedies, which I've been provided by Mr. Albertine. It's still in draft mode, and I understand that they'll be finalizing this report, and it's the intent of that committee that this report be made subject of the record as this bill moves forward. So they're in the process of concluding that another couple of weeks. Is that right, Mr. Albertine?
Chair Williams, that's correct, and thank you for bringing that to us.
So we will, this was a sort of a good introductory hearing on this subject. This will come back further for hearing and work session when they'll have that final copy of the report. And I just recommend that to the extent we're going to accept the report as part of the record, that if in scheduling the hearing we can get a copy of the report to the members in advance of the hearing so they can review it if they've got any questions for you or any other members of the committee that are going to be present at that time. It would be nice to have that. It's a fairly dense read for those of you who are interested, and so it's something that we'd rather do beforehand as opposed to be hit with it just right at the hearing level. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question. Does the report address we talked about earlier, the fact that this does not include a remedy expressly in the statute in the event of failure to notice? Does the report address that the committee discussed this and then decided not to address it within the bill because there are other remedies implicit in court's powers? I'm just thinking of somebody doing the legislative research on this 25 years hence, wondering what was the legislature thinking here? What sorts of remedies are available where that rare case has come along out of Georgia where they just didn't do the research and they missed this requirement? Now what? At least to reflect that we addressed it, that we decided that there are inherent powers in a court to to deal with cases where the notice might not have been given. Is that covered in the report?
Representative Shatterly, Chair Williams, members of the committee, that point is not specifically covered in the report, but now that you have raised that and it's been raised by other committee members, it's appropriate to put some time into and include that in the report. That will not delay the report. That is something that is memorialized in the committee minutes, and it's easy to make that transfer into the report.
I think that'd be helpful.
Yeah, I do too. Okay, thank you. We'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2099. And colleagues, want to thank you for what was a light and entertaining first substantive committee meeting, and we'll call this meeting adjourned.
I made it.
Can we get a clip note on the full report for the ones that